Welcome to the What's Your Weird Story podcast.
Everyone has at least one good story.
And some of us have stories that are just to the left of normal.
We're interested in the ones that push the boundaries of what we can perceive.
Stories that defy explanations.
Stories with an air of mystery.
Stories we might not share.
For fear of being thought of differently.
But don't worry. We're all friends here. So, what's your weird story?
Hello, Weirdsville. Welcome to the What's Your Weird Story podcast. Hope everyone is doing well and everyone is enjoying the cooler time of the year. With me, as always, is my better part and the cooler half of this this duo. I am one of your hosts, Barry Johnston, but with me, as always, my best friend, the professor, Mr. Adam Beebe. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much, oh smiling sensei. How's it good?
Everything's good. I had a good weekend. I had my son down for the weekend and his friend, and we had a good time. We hung out, had some good food, and it's good. Everything's good. How about you, man?
Same thing, except for completely different. I had a kind of a casual weekend. I didn't work as much. I worked on some art. Nice. And some getting things ready for the holidays and such. And speaking of holidays, we just had yesterday being Veterans Day, 11/11. So we want to thank all of our friends and family members and all who have served in the U.S. military.
Absolutely.
And pay respect to those because, you know, I'm not a soldier. Barry could probably be a soldier, but definitely more of a soldier than me. I'm not a soldier. So I would appreciate those. Our friends and family members who've served.
Yeah, absolutely, man. We've had some great stories on here. We've talked about veterans in the past, and we've had great stories on with folks and people that their families have served. And I never served, and like you, I got the most respect for people that do that. And it's really an amazing thing. And it's kind of cool because our guest on this episode is a veteran and just a phenomenal guy.
Yes, today's guest, John Mollick, is he's joining us from upstate New York, and this is his weird stories are about his occupation and things that he's done in his life.
These are some of the coolest stories, by the way, man. Right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
this
yeah,
is
yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is a podcast that like we've been sitting on waiting for it to come out, and it delivers, man. I just want to say that.
Yeah, well, it's delivered because of you, sir. We had series of events, but we can describe those
bizarre later. And unfortunate.
Yes, events. How they oddly kind of connect into our guest story. But this is a unique type of occupation and story, and it is what, you know, just to show you again the great diversity of stories that we hear here in Weirdsville and what we look for. All stories, all comers. But today's comer is John. And John, thank you so much for joining us. What's your weird story?
Oh, my weird story. Thanks for having me first, guys.
Yeah.
My weird story would be that I spent 14 years as an organized crime investigator for the New York State Attorney General's Office.
Wow.
And the number one investigative tool that we had was the wiretap.
Wow.
And so I've spent many years listening to thousands and thousands of phone calls, looking at hundreds of videos and reading thousands of text messages of individuals all across sometimes the world, really the North America, I would say. And I've got a whole bunch of stories that come with that. 14 wow. years. So
wow.
That's, yeah.
Wow.
That's really cool. And also in that 14 years, you must have seen such a growth in the different kinds of communication technology, I would imagine.
Yeah, I certainly. I mean, the traditional phone call is there. It was there when I started. And it's there yep. today. And text messages and videos and things like that. But certainly we've got a change in the platforms, if you will, right? So mm-hmm. Telegram is popular today when regular text messages or SMS, we used to call them short messaging services, were most popular years ago. And there are more challenging intercept there's challenges to intercept, lawful intercept today because of the point-to-point end-to-end encryption
yeah.
technologies that are out there.
Right.
So you have other investigative techniques to use, if you will, to try and get into those messages. Yeah. Obviously, all with the authority of a judge, a legal
of law, course.
Right.
This is, I have two backgrounds. I have a law enforcement background and a military background. And when we're talking law enforcement background, it's all up and up, clearly, with yeah. the warrant signed by a judge yeah. and all those good things. So,
wow. Okay. So,
yes.
So, so you get started in this field, and I'm imagining somebody has to file for, we're interested in looking into this person or whatever the case may be. I don't know what you need yeah. to do that, but what's that like to start getting into that, man? What's that whole world about?
Yeah. So, usually, 90% of the time, I'd say 9 out of 10 times, it comes from a UC or a CI, so an undercover or a confidential informant.
Okay.
And my agency was a big agency, but I worked for a small team.
Right? Okay.
So I worked for the New York State Attorney General's office, which is a big organization. But I worked for their organized crime task force, which was wow. relatively small in number. And yeah. so we had satellite offices in Albany, Syracuse, Buffalo, and then our main headquarters was down in White Plains, which is just north out of New York City. And so we would get referrals, really. We would get other law enforcement agencies would come in and say, listen, we've been dealing with this knucklehead.
Okay.
Doing A, B, C, D, and this is the type of target or, potential defendant that looks like they're working with a much larger organized crime group,
yeah.
Whether it just be narcotics or gangs or whatever it is. And so we want to do more than just buy bust him, right? Or we want to do more than just arrest this guy and take him off the street. We want to get into what he's doing and
right.
figure yeah. out where his stuff is coming from. And stuff.
Right.
So, and then wow. they would come to us because we have the technology to do the wiretaps. It's very, very expensive to do that. It takes a lot of server space. It takes a lot of technicians. It takes just a lot. And so a lot of the smaller agencies and even some of the bigger ones, to be honest, don't have large sheriff's departments. They just don't have the money to do
right.
wires.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they come to us. We've got a smaller team, but we got all the stuff.
Yeah.
And so they bring the bodies and we bring the cool equipment.
Wow. So, so like you yeah. gotta have like a, that's gotta be a crazy. They've got to have a real understanding of what that person is doing to want to throw that kind of money at it. So that's got to be a pretty. You've already got to be tipped off to a degree of what's going on,
yeah.
and then now you're just trying to grab evidence and stuff like that.
Yeah. So I'll give you an example. I just left 2 years ago. I'm 2 years now. I've been in my full time Army position, which is something completely different we could talk about later. But
okay.
My last case before I came into this current position, another agency, and I'm not going to talk about agencies or I'm not going to give names or anything.
Yeah.
I can mm-hmm. give generalized stuff, right?
Sure.
So another agency was buying fentanyl pills from a knucklehead in one of our cities here. And just so happened that this and they were using a confidential informant to do it. They had an informant that was trying to work off some time from a previous charge.
Okay.
So the informant decided to give up this person and say, hey, I know somebody who's selling fentanyl pills. I call them blues. Selling blues, and I think he's looking to offload some guns, too. So
wow.
The other agency introduced an undercover, which the target went for. So the target accepted the UC, if you will, and the UC started dealing with the target buying fentanyl pills, and then started asking about the gun issue. And the target was willing to sell, but we couldn't get any information at all on where they're coming from, and they weren't purchased lawfully locally, or they weren't even real guns. They were ghost guns. So what was happening is they were purchasing all the gun manufacturing equipment that hobbyists use, and then they were building these weapons locally right in their house, right? And then they were putting them together and selling it. But the guy we were buying them from wasn't doing any of that. He didn't know how to do any of that crap. So he was getting it from somebody else.
Yeah.
Okay. And we knew all this stuff coming in. So the other agency said, this sounds like a good wire. So, or potential wire, because one, we have no idea where the fentanyl pills are coming from. And fentanyl was becoming, at this time, 2-3 years ago when I started this case, was a big deal. I mean, overdoses are a real problem right now
with fentanyl.
And we couldn't get our hands on where this guy or gal was that was putting together these ghost gun parts and then selling them to these knuckleheads and then eventually back to us. And these knuckleheads weren't just doing this for profit. They were carrying some of these weapons themselves, and they weren't the nicest people either.
Right.
And so there was a potential that there can be some violence involved. So that's how it starts. And the probable cause, obviously you need probable cause in order to wiretap a phone. And so the probable cause already came in with the referral, because they were using an undercover cell phone to make the purchases into a cell phone that the defendant or the target was using. And so we then present all of that information to the judge and say, he's using this device to communicate, to sell weapons and fentanyl, whatever. And if you do that a certain amount of times in New York state law, then that's enough probable cause to assume he's committing this crime, and the judge can sign a warrant for that phone.
Okay.
Now, to put everybody at ease out there, because this is a question I get all the time, at least in New York state, and I know it is the same way federally, because we've worked with federal agencies doing this stuff as well, that there's something called exhaustion. And so because eavesdropping is the legal term, wiretapping is the most intrusive law enforcement technique that exists, because you literally are able to listen to somebody's private phone calls, potentially video, if that's the kind of the wire you're doing, that you have to demonstrate to a judge that you have exhausted every other law enforcement technique that we know of.
Gotcha.
Okay.
In order to get the evidence for this crime before you get to eavesdropping. Okay. And so, and you have to prove it in your affidavit. You have to say, I did this and I did this and I did this and I did this. And none of these things worked. I tried to introduce another undercover. I tried to put cameras all over the house. I tried to do surveillance all day long, whatever it was, right? All of these things, and you keep coming up against the wall. And if you can prove to the judge that the only tactic I have left is to literally wiretap the person's cell phone, then you can get the judge to sign that. You got to prove it first.
Okay.
So to alleviate any fears that cops are running around there just listening to everybody's phones.
That's good to know. Thank God. Thank God. Yeah. They're not listening to my conversation.
Can I just listen to this guy's phone? No.
Wow, man. Okay, I had a question, and it's leaving me. I'll come back to it.
So if you want, I'll go ahead and tell you the rest of the story. This is a pretty interesting case that we had here. Yeah. So where did it go, right? So first, boy, there's some interesting parts of this. So eventually, come to find out, this knucklehead number one, right, is the guy that I was referring to that the UC was originally buying into. He had a friend who was kind of a local guy, but he had a lot more money than the original guy that we were dealing with, right? And the original guy, though, wasn't that bright. So as soon as we got the warrant signed, we went up on his phone, right? We started listening to his phone and all the legal ways that we could do that.
Yep.
And knucklehead number one would call his buddy, and they would just talk openly on the phone as if there was no issues, right? They weren't smart about anything.
Yeah.
So we were very quickly able to what we call jump from one device to the next device. So we started with Knucklehead One and then got onto his buddy's phone and we could start listening to him, right?
Okay.
And that's how you jump and you create an organization. You
wow. keep going from one to the other. This is super elaborate, right? I mean, are we talking weeks worth of conversations and things like that?
It depends.
Okay.
It depends on what the defendant's doing. So,
yeah.
They're not a defendant yet, right? We call them a target. So it depends on what the target's doing. In this instance, we listened to the first guy for, if my memory serves, I want to say 10 days probably.
Wow.
And we had evidence on day one. I mean, right off the bat, as soon as we were up on the phone, we got the order from the phone company.
So you're monitoring that live? Is that what's...
Have to.
Okay. We have okay, to. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, and that's a... That is a clear factor, a requirement, whether you're state or federal, you have to monitor that phone live. You cannot, what you call, like, record and then post-listen. You right. cannot do that. You have to be within the location that you have, and when I mean within the location, I mean physical location. You got to be in the place you told the judge that you were going to listen to the phones. Mm. You have to do it in the way you told the judge you were going to do it, and you have to do it live. If you are not there and you are not listening to it live, you are not allowed to use that stuff as evidence.
Wow. Okay. I did not know that.
So, yeah, and it all has to do with something called minimization, which is... Another thing that makes the eavesdropping restricted is that when we go to a judge and we say this person's doing these bad things, we are only allowed to listen to conversations, read text messages, whatever, as it relates to that crime that we said he was committing.
Gotcha. Right.
Right. Gotcha. He or she. So if he picks up the phone and starts talking to his mother about doing the laundry, we're not allowed to listen to that phone call. Right. And so that's why you have to have somebody, a trained investigator who knows how to do these things. You can't just bring in like a road cop and just sit him on a wire and have him sit wires. You can't do that. They have to have training and experience, and they have to monitor this stuff live so they can make that live determination that this is a, what we call a pertinent conversation or a non-pertinent conversation. If it's non-pertinent and you continue to listen, you can end up losing your whole wire. The whole thing can be thrown out.
Okay. Yep. Wow.
Yeah. I heard there's a horror story from years ago. It wasn't my case and it was years before I got on the job, but they had a wire run out of, I don't remember specifically, and it doesn't matter, but they had a wire that they were running and some untrained cops came in and didn't really understand the minimization process. So they were listening to everything.
Yeah.
And there was a phone sex phone call that came in where the defendant was doing his handling business with his girlfriend.
All right.
Right.
Yeah.
And they ended up listening to the whole thing because they thought it was funny.
Oh.
20, 30 minutes. Right. And you can just imagine these cops are like, oh, my God, this is great. Ah. Yeah,
right.
Judge finds out we lost the whole wire.
Wow.
All gone.
Wow.
So it's actually it's pretty restrictive stuff.
Wow. That's good to know, man. That's good to know.
Yeah.
So even within the investigation, there's still some protection of the privacy of the
individual. 100%.
Yeah. Yep. So that's, which is, that's, it's good to know that you have that, but still, the mere fact that you're listening into them obviously means that they're a suspect, they're the target, and that there's a reason that you're doing that. So,
yeah. Oh, 100, yes. Yeah. We're not anywhere near somebody's phone unless we've demonstrated enough probable cause to the judge. And then the exhaustion on top of it, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And then, even more restrictions, there's the restricted relationships that regardless of what they're talking about, unless it gets a little funky here, but unless I can demonstrably prove that they're committing a crime with an individual in this restricted relationship, I'm not allowed to listen to that. So that's husband, wife, so marital, let's just put it there. There's marital, doctor, patient,
right.
Clergy. There's seven total, and I forget exactly what all of them are. And lawyer and lawyer. Client, right?
Yeah.
So if they pick up the phone and they make a phone call and the person answers on the other end and they say, hi, this is Dr. So-and-so, done, over, boop.
Gotcha.
When you're not listening to anything. It's none of our business. We have nothing to do with it. Now, gotcha. It can be true that you could be working a case, say, like somebody's buying fentanyl, or not fentanyl, but it would be oxycodone from a doctor.
Right.
And so if you had if you had reason to believe that was the case, then you could specifically articulate to a judge why you would need to listen to that restricted phone call. And then you could be given a little bit of leeway.
Yeah.
But it's a short leash.
Yeah.
It's a real short leash. And if you're not close, like if you don't have that evidence and you're not able to get to that point very quickly, the judge is going to cut you off.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But if you're listening to a conversation and they talk to somebody who goes by the name like Dr. Feelgood, you probably still okay to listen on that one.
Yeah, I would imagine. I guess. Yeah. Well,
you know, if the warrant, if you got to abide by the warrant, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
It all depends. So, so in this case, we ended up finding out that there was somebody, another individual in this investigation who was purchasing these gun parts from places all across the country, and he was manufacturing them in his house. The day we did a search warrant on his location at the end of the case, he had like 30 weapons in the house that he was in some various stage of production.
Wow. Right? Wow.
And he was selling them to these multiple people, but to the people that we originally were listening to. And he would be artistic about it. So they made one that they called the Iron Man gun, and it had the colors of the Iron Man.
Okay.
So it had the gold and handle and whatever, they called it Iron Man. And they had one called the Tiffany gun, which is Tiffany blue from the Tiffany gun from, you know, the Tiffany store, the famous blue color.
Yeah.
So, thankfully, we were able to get our hands on that. And then we were also able to trace the fentanyl all the way back at least to where it was coming across the border in Arizona. So that's the interesting thing about working in the state, too. Even though I work for New York State, if I can articulate to the judge that a crime is being committed outside of my state, but it affects our state, we can go after that crime.
Wow.
Right? If it has nothing to do with New York, then I'm out.
Right.
But
right.
If you're affecting the state, if you're selling drugs in Oklahoma and using the proceeds to purchase real estate in New York, we can go after you.
Gotcha. Right?
So in this instance, this individual was getting his fentanyl pills from a cartel in the southern part of the border in Arizona. They actually had a dirty contractor on the border that they were able to get the pills over with. It's a whole other thing. But
wow.
Anyways, and this guy was selling it in Chicago, New York City, and then up where I'm from up here. So we were able to actually wiretap the phones of the guys that were in Arizona, even though we're a prosecuting agency from New York.
Wow.
Because we could prove that the money and the fentanyl was coming here. So
when did you start seeing fentanyl being a real issue when did that come on your radar?
Yeah, so it would be, let's see, I went to Afghanistan in 2012, and our first fentanyl case was probably 2014.
Okay.
The first actual investigation that focused on fentanyl in my office would have been the one I was just talking about, when it was the primary drug. Right?
Okay.
Other investigations, there were primary, it was either coke or heroin or whatever it was, and then we would come across fentanyl pills either, or we would come across heroin laced with fentanyl, or we would get, you know, other stuff where fentanyl happened to be kind of an ancillary part of the case, if you will. But the first one where we actually went after it pretty hard, and specifically, was that first one I did in 2019.
Wow.
2021.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah.
It's really taken over this country, man. We got a real problem, you know?
Yeah. It's not good. I actually, on my show, I just did two episodes ago, I talked specifically about the fentanyl challenge that we're having here in the U.S. And not only from an addiction standpoint, but because I focus on foreign affairs and military conflict, about how China it originates there. So they produce the fentanyl in liquid form. They put it into 55-gallon barrels, and then they ship the stuff over to Mexico. And then in Mexico, they end up converting it either into powder form, which they use to either lace heroin with, or they're pressing it into these fentanyl pills they call blue 30s in particular. So, and the point of that is to try and get the fentanyl pills to look exactly like oxycodones look coming from a doctor's office. So you're trying to convince the users that it's not fentanyl. It's no, this is real stuff. This came from my doctor, blah, blah, blah. Even though it's the trash that comes from China through Mexico, yeah.
Wow.
Jeez.
It's scary stuff.
How many cases were you a part of that made it all the way to court? Were there a lot? Too many to number?
Yeah. Yeah, so my office is weird in that way. We don't do a lot of initiating case stuff. Meaning we don't do a lot of first buys and then it turns into nothing type stuff. If it's with us, it's already a case.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you made it to our office, so
sure.
I probably sat in my. I got on the job in 2008, left in 2001. I probably sat 15 wires because wires go anywhere from 4 months, 3 months. They can go to 2 years, 3 years.
Okay.
Depending on how big the case is.
Wow.
So I sat probably 15 and yeah, in that amount of time. And a whole host of stuff, gangs, fentanyl, coke, anything you can think of.
Wow.
What was the longest lengthwise one that you had?
I want to say we did one that was about a year and a half. We did a pretty big gang case that got pretty large. Your international cases can go much longer than that.
Right.
For obvious reasons, you're jumping so many ladders to get from where you started all the way to where you're going. Right. Got a few buddies on what we call the DEA task force up here. And, they got cases that start locally and end up in Peru. Right. It takes a long time for them to get to that point. And in my case, in my experience, typically, that case that I was just talking about where we got to Arizona, that's atypical. We usually don't get to that point, but we had enough evidence and it was clear enough and we got to where we got to go. Normally what we would do in upstate New York is we would get to the point where we would identify the major players down in the city, in New York City, which is about 3 hours south of me. And then we would kind of wrap up our end of the case there. And if we had enough evidence, we would pass it off to somebody else, right? We would give the end of that case to NYPD and they would run with it, or we would give it to DEA and they would run with it.
Gotcha.
Because, I'm based in upstate New York and I don't have all the resources to be running around New York City looking for these folks. And all these other agencies do. So a lot of our time was developing the case locally. We get ourselves down to our source city, which is New York City most of the time, sometimes Boston. But, and then kind of wrap up from there.
Would you ever have to testify?
All the time.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So the only way, not the only way, but the way that this works is that you start with a warrant, you present it to the judge, you go up on your first device and then off you go. Right. And you have this entire case and you grab all of these other devices and you build out this organization, you figure out who's doing what. Mm-hmm. In order for you to actually then get the arrest warrants and potentially search warrants, because these are all felony charges, you have to go in front of a grand jury.
Okay.
And so I have to present, if let's say I'm the affiant on the case, meaning I'm the lead, I got to go in with the prosecutors and we have to take all of the evidence that we've gathered since the first phone, everything that we've done, and play all the phone calls we want, and we play them for a grand jury, typically anywhere from 14 to 20 people. And we ask them to consider whether these are chargeable offenses. And that's how grand jury work. And they make the determination. And we say, here's all the evidence we have. Do you think these are chargeable? Not guilty. We're not asking for guilt. That happens at trial. We're just asking if you think there's enough evidence for us to get an arrest warrant for this individual so they can potentially bring them to trial.
Yeah.
And so we do that. So it usually takes, depending on how many phone calls you have and how many bad guys you have, right, can take me a week of 40 hours sitting at a computer making phone calls and testifying in front of all of these grand jurors.
Right.
And then eventually you go out and you arrest all these people. And they each get all of their attorneys, their representatives. And if they decide to plead not guilty and they want to take it to trial, then we end up in trial playing all of these calls and presenting all the evidence against whichever defendants decided to plead not guilty. And then you get cross-examined by defense attorneys. Happened many, many times.
Wow, man. Wow. Yeah. I mean, I hate to even ask what the craziest trial you were ever a part of, but any that stick out in your mind?
Yeah, we had we had the longest trial in all of Albany County history. In this would be, boy, oh boy, when would this be? I think it was also when I just got back from Afghanistan. So it was before we started, 2013, 2014, memory serves. Okay. Right? And there were six defendants. So the lead knucklehead, I keep using that term, but I'm just going to,
it's the nicest thing. It worked.
We know,
worked.
We're familiar.
The lead knucklehead thought he was a jailhouse lawyer. So we went out, we got our grand jury warrants, we arrested everybody. Most of the individuals in the case said, I'm out, you guys got a wire, like, there's no way, like, what's my deal, right? Taking a deal.
Yep.
Well, this guy couldn't get bail. And even though we presented him with all of the grand jury minutes and all of the evidence, he's like, no, I'm going to beat this thing. I was sitting in jail and I read that he decided he found a loophole.
Okay.
Right, in the law. And he convinced five of his other buddies who were involved that he had this thing wrapped up. And so take it to trial. We're going to beat it. And we're all going to get out of here. Okay. So we went to trial, all six defendants at once. So when you testify, I'm up there. Again, it wasn't my main case. So it was a lot of cops that I was help supporting in this case particular, because again, I was in Afghanistan at the time, but these cops are up there and they're testifying to all these phone calls, and then they have to get crossed by every single defense attorney.
Oh, wow. Right?
So six defense attorneys in a row.
Wow.
Because they're, no matter who you're discussing, which defendant it is, they all have a relationship in some way in the conspiracy to the other defendants.
Right.
So all defense attorneys get a shot at
you. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. But anyways, long story short, Knucklehead was wrong. And we knew that. So, they ended up losing a trial. And if my memory serves, geez, I want to say he got 120, got 120 years when it was done.
Holy shit.
And, which was the interesting thing, because we had told him numerous times before the trial started, we were like, listen, we're not joking with you. You're just wrong. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not us trying to fool you, right? Like, we're sitting here in front of the defense attorney with our prosecutor, the cops are in the room, and we're just telling you, you're wrong, right? You're wrong, and you're going to lose a trial. And if you lose a trial, you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison. And he just thought that we were lying. And we said, then, okay. So we went to trial. He got 120 years. And so the funny part was, that's not funny, but he ended up appealing that sentence because it was excessive, he thought. He said, come on, 120 years, you know, I'm 35 years old. What are you doing to me? You know, I was just selling drugs. I didn't murder anybody. So he actually filed an appeal, and it went up to the appellate court in New York State. And the appellate court agreed with him. And they said, you know what, that was pretty excessive. Given what you did, yes, it was bad and drugs and all those things. But yeah, you didn't kill anybody. So how 77? And that was that. So he got 77 years.
77 years.
Yeah, they took 50 off the top.
Yeah, right.
That's very generous, man.
That's
great. He'll be happy with that, dude.
Wow.
So he might make it out.
So that must have been, that was a huge drug bust, right? I mean, that would be a big one, right? Or am I wrong?
Yeah, we had, in that whole case, I want to say, you know, there's just so many in my mind. I want to say there were 35, 40 defendants in that case. Six of them went to trial. The rest of them pled. And, you know, the drug amounts were okay. I want to say we had a couple of kilos at the end of the case and a couple of handguns and some cars, and we did some search warrants and stuff.
Yeah.
It wasn't massive, but, you know, big enough.
Big enough.
Well, that's like, it's, you know, 35 whatever plus people out, you know.
Yeah,
getting the bad shit off the streets, man.
Sure. Yeah.
Is can I ask, if this is too sensitive, then please don't answer. But
you can ask anything you want.
Is organized crime still a big thing on the East Coast, or is that gone?
That's actually a really good question. People get asked that. We get asked that all the time. So there is what we call wise guy crime. It's still there. Mm-hmm. It's particularly in New York, as you might imagine, some of the bigger cities. And when I say New York, I live in New York, but when I say New York, I mean New York City. That's what all of us New Yorkers say. So down in the city, and, it's there, you know, they pressure unions to do stuff. You know, there really is some Sopranos type stuff. John Gotti type stuff. As a matter of fact, my office, the Organized Crime Task Force, was responsible in part for that big Gotti case. So if you watch the Netflix documentary called Getting Gotti or Got Gotti.
Yes, yes, yes.
That OCTF, which is the organization that was involved in the wiretaps on Gotti, was my organization. Now, I wasn't around for that, right? I was young,
right. Amazing, man.
So that still exists, but it's not to the extent that it used to be.
Right.
I mean, wise guy crime was a lot bigger 50 years ago. So when we say organized crime today, we're really talking about like national and international narcotics organizations, gun running organizations, gangs, you know, Bloods, Crips, that type of stuff, or local little gangbangers that we have here.
Has that gotten worse over the years? Did you see an incline of this type of stuff, or did you ever see it sort of peter out? I mean, what does it look like from that point of view? I mean, are we doing a good job, you know?
You know, when people ask me that question, I'll put it this way. There are amazing guys and gals that are doing the hard work every day.
Sure.
And have been since the beginning to try and keep this poison off the streets. They really are. And, but it's hard. And, you know, you're dealing with a supply and demand issue, which is really, really which is challenging to defeat. You're dealing with an addiction problem, which is really challenging to defeat. And you know, I hate to say it as a member of law enforcement for so long and a lot of friends still in the business, but I've never met anybody in my work that said we're winning the war on drugs.
Sure.
Not one.
It's an epidemic, man, and it's only gotten worse, unfortunately. And it sucks because, you know, when we were growing up, you know, people did cocaine, people did heroin, you know, it was always there, but fentanyl has changed the game. People are dying quickly, and it's sad, and it's funny, not funny, sorry, it's not funny, but in a related way, I think we lost Adam for a second, but I'll tell you, one of the principals at our school, she was even wearing gloves when she went through this kid's backpack, and some of the powder got on her skin, and she was out. They had to take her to the emergency room. It almost killed her.
And it can.
That's just crazy.
I can again get into the skin, and it can enter the body that way, or get in through the eyes, you know, the nose, the mucous membranes, and it's powerful stuff. I mean, it's depending on what the what's the word I'm looking for? Like the concentration,
right?
It's anywhere from 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine. So,
wow.
It's bad. And so, and another one of the reasons they're turning, they being these international drug organizations, are turning the powder into pill form, not only to try and trick the users into thinking it's legitimate oxys, but because they can regulate how much fentanyl they put into each pill much more easily than they can with the powder. And so they're not, it's sad to say this, but they're not killing their user base.
Right.
I mean, if you put too much of it in, then you're going to kill so many people, who's going to buy it. I mean, it's an awful way to say it, but
is fentanyl like heroin or, oxy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. So they're all the downers.
It's just super potent, right? Is that the deal?
Yep.
Super potent.
So, it's technically actually referred to as an opioid. So just like opium, which is where morphine and heroin come from, the opium plant, most of it from Afghanistan, right? Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, they produce a lot of it. But
so it's basically like high powered heroin.
It's a synthetic, isn't it? I think it is.
It's synthetic. Yep. It's produced to act in the same way that all of the drugs, morphine, heroin, opium, they all come from the poppy plant. And, they're all created differently, but they have different processes to be made. But you know, fentanyl was produced in a lab in order to get the same effect, but just to get a stronger effect. And it has legitimate purposes. It's given to end of life cancer patients, people that are awful trauma accidents, those type of things, where the the craziest pain you can imagine, fentanyl has a use for that, right?
So
it's been around for a very long time. It's just now getting to the streets, and just killing people.
Yeah. Sucks. Yeah.
So they're basically putting fentanyl into a pill form and then sending it across the border.
Yeah. It's twofold for the pills. It's one, because you're trying to convince the user that it's an actual oxycodone product and it's coming from the doctor and they'll trust you more and want to use it. And then you can regulate more easily how much of the fentanyl goes into each dosage, right? Each unit itself. And because when you sprinkle that stuff, literally sprinkle the stuff on top of marijuana, which you can do, or you can mix it in with with some coke, which people do, even though coke does the exact opposite of heroin, and fentanyl, which is a crazy, anyways, you know, it's very challenging to ensure that you get the right amount there so you don't give too much and something like that happens to your principal, you know. But if you do it in pill form and it's produced in these super labs down in Mexico, it's a lot easier to do that way.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it's the opioid epidemic with the, I just blanked on it, not the fentanyl, but the Oxycontin, yes.
Oh.
The doors that really opened, I mean, that's what opened up the whole, where, you know, fentanyl became popular to move in, I think. I don't know.
You're totally right. You're spot on. You know, heroin's been around a long time, right? Drug use like that's been around a long time, right? China, they did opium for millennia, right? And people were doing heroin in the Vietnam years and in the 60s and 70s, right? Mm-hmm. So it's always been here. But you're right to say that in the 90s, there absolutely was an increase in addiction with an over-prescribing of pain medication, particularly with oxys, which got people hooked. It did. And, you know, it's not an opinion anymore. I mean, this is fact that's been brought up in court and companies have been sued, right? I mean, and then what happens is when the government cracks down, as they should, and doctors get serious and they stop throwing these pills at you every time you have a hangnail, then people are at a loss and they start going through withdrawals and they don't know what to do. So then we had a transition to heroin when there was a lot more people using heroin than we had seen in many, many years. This would be 10 to 15 years ago when we saw that heroin increase. Is when I first got in 2008, very few heroin cases. Everything was coke, really. I mean, there's a lot of coke all over the place. And weed, right? No one really cares about weed anymore. But ecstasy, that was around and stuff. But really, there's a lot of coke. And heroin was there, but again, you didn't do a lot of cases. Well, then you transition again to about 10 years ago, bunch of heroin. And then these got the idea of using fentanyl and then trying to convince users that they were using the pills and creating the pills to make them look like, you know, because there's a stigma, especially if you're dealing with, and I got to be careful the way that I say this because I don't want to be rude, but when you're dealing with a certain socioeconomic group of people that are dealing with an addiction issue that started with too many pills from the doctor, but now the brain and the body are really trying to get their hands on it. So they want, and they get to the point where they're using heroin, there's still a stigma for that for them. And so if you can fill the need by creating another pill, it makes it easier for them to accept the fact that they have an issue. Right.
Yeah.
Because it's just a pill. And
heroin's dirty because of needles and all that. And it is, obviously. Yep. But there is that bigger kind of that bigger taboo to it, I guess. Maybe where it's still very it's perceived to be worse, I suppose, because of the people you see who are strung out on heroin, the junkies, and how they are historically presented in it and present themselves. And I've known people who were, you know, addicted to heroin who did not appear it. But, most people who are, it's not a recreational narcotic. It's a lifestyle. What they have to do. And it's sad. And then now it's moved on to pills, which are much more
easily hidden and more accessible and don't leave track marks and all of that stuff. And it's just, it's tragic. I mean, it's just insane how it's just, you know, how they, it's, and it's also weird how there's these trends in the American drug culture, you know, of what people are really like, oh, we're all doing this now. Not we're all doing this now, but that's what the thing is, the more popular, it seems to be the more popular or more dangerous, I guess, because we're looking at it in news reports and media. But it is bizarre how things kind of like come in and out of, you know, without, you know, coming in and out of fashion, I suppose. But maybe it's
You're right. You're right. I mean, it's look at that heroin use in the 70s and then coke in the 80s, right? And then you had, I mean, how many people did we know in the 90s going to college using ecstasy?
Yeah.
So there is a social, you know, there's a social wave, if you will, back and forth. And what's really frustrating to me, again, working a little bit in the law enforcement realm, like we've been talking about here, but spent a lot of time in the foreign affairs world, that you have these external influencers, in particular when it comes to fentanyl, is China is specifically selling this stuff and knowingly bringing it over to Mexico, knowing it's going to get into the United States because they want to cause social upheaval.
Right.
In the same way that the Russians wanted to do it in 2016 with the elections. It's all part of what they call their military information operations plans.
And, yeah.
You know, the CCP, Chinese Communist Party, is not going to come out and never admit it. Okay.
Right.
I'm not going to say that they're actively producing it themselves, right? But they turn a blind eye to the organized crime that's over there.
Right.
Because they know it causes an issue for us. And then the democracies look weak because we can't control our drug problem. And then he gets to go back to his people and say, listen, this is why communism works. We don't have a fentanyl issue.
Right.
We don't have school shootings. We don't have a border crisis. We don't have fentanyl problems. The United States and its brethren there in the West and all their funky democracies, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And it's sad because now we're dealing, and it's not to say that we wouldn't have some addiction issues without them, of course. I'm not saying that, but it certainly is an external influencer that's like, if you just stop doing that, buddy, you'd make it a little easier for us and the people that are struggling here. But you know, they don't care.
Yeah, well, that's part of war. And it's a, you know, it's an undeclared war. It's an economic war. It is also that kind of, you know, like you're saying, trying to destabilize, you know, the element, especially the top superpower, basically, in the world, you know, and when you're gunning for that number one spot, you know, and that's why people, that's why a lot of these international influences hit the United States in various ways and various factions to cause chaos. And we can look in, especially in the that past 20 years or so, you know, at what happens when you have these mass stirrings of chaos. We become more divided and we look disorganized. We look less to the outside world and we lose kind of our, you know, respectability and face and all of that. And we're not necessarily nobody elected us to be the leader of the planet, but we are in a way the most, we're the most rich, we get the most resources. We've got, you know, a massive cultural influence over the entire globe. We export the idea of America and all of this stuff, but they're trying to poison a little bit of the well, I guess, you know, cause that dissension and cause that chaos, like you said.
Poisonous. Yeah,
exactly. Poisonous also. Yeah. And I mean, we've done it to, our government has, you know, in the past done certain activities that were similar, you know, but it was during war, you know, and war is about the end goal. It's about the end goal is about winning and stuff, you know? So,
yeah,
anyway, I digress.
So did your history in the military, did that lead you into your position with the AG?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is absolutely. So I joined the Army in 1997, and I joined as an intelligence analyst. And I went to Iraq in 05. That was my first deployment. And when I got back, I worked for, I was still in the National Guard, obviously. I've been in the National Guard ever since. I still am today. But there are opportunities, even though most people think National Guard is 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks in the summer kind of stuff, right? There yeah. are full-time jobs within the National Guard. So you can be in the Guard, but do it full-time. And I got a full-time job working for the New York Counter-Drug Program. And based on my intelligence analysis experience, I was hired to be a criminal analyst as a soldier. So I was getting paid by the Army to do criminal analyst work for the DEA here locally. And so I would go to work every day, get paid by the Army, and help DEA agents do investigative analysis on international drug organizations, right? I wasn't a cop, I was just an analyst. But while I was there, full-time job opportunities opened up while I was there. And one of them was the Attorney General's office. So I applied to work at the AG's office and I got the job, and that is an investigative job. So they put me through the police academy and I did that in 2008. So from 2008 to 2021, my part-time job was Army and my full-time job was doing this investigative work for organized crime.
Cool.
I stopped doing that in 2021. And I went back to doing full-time Army, and now I am the Director of Intelligence and Security for the New York National Guard, both Army and Air.
Wow.
I do that full-time. Yeah.
So this is so interesting, and you have such a passion for what you do.
Yeah. I did an interview last night, and I talked a little bit about this. I love it every day. I mean, even having this conversation with you guys tonight is not something that is drudgery by any means. This is fun for me to do, and I can talk about Israel, Gaza, or arresting drug folks, or I can talk about, last night I was on a weather podcast, and I was talking to the guys about how weather affects military operations and how it did in the past, and how right. we postponed D-Day because of it, and listen, mm-hmm. I can go on and on. I absolutely love it, and I love not only the work, but I love the soldiers, and that really is the key. And yeah. You know, that's going to sound a little corny. It's going to sound a little tacky, but I love teaching and mentoring soldiers to do this work. And so if the Army's going to keep allowing me to do that, I'm going to keep doing it.
That's awesome. It's vital and it's important. So we appreciate on both ends, the military and police service. We appreciate both ends of that, of the spectrum of what you've done, the service that you've done for the community and the country in general and in large and all of that.
So, it,
now, one quick question, and this is maybe a little sidelining, but off the normal path, but when you were at Police Academy, was it anything like the Police Academy movies that we grew up with when we were kids? Because man, I loved those.
Yeah. You know what? The answer is yes. Listen, the Academy can be very serious for obvious reasons, right?
Yeah.
And then there can be some fun times and where, you know, senior cops are busting on recruits and, you know, we're running around hallways with stupid hats on and saying funny things because they're trying to embarrass us. And, you know, I got pepper sprayed one day and called my boss immediately afterwards and said, you make me do that again, I'm quitting. I'm never doing that again. You know, I'm rolling around in my bed at night with my wife and I'm getting like more drip goo in my eyes, and it's just a whole night. I'll give you a funny one from the Academy. Here's a funny one, right? So at the end of our Academy here, at least locally, so we do something called street survival. So you're in the last week of the Academy, you and your team are in, and you're doing felony car stops, and you're learning how to do felony search warrants and those kind of things. It's the most advanced stuff you're going to do in the Academy. It's trying to stay safe while you're out there. And there's this really cool drill that we did with one of the local PDs around here that had some great trainers, and kind of call it the box drill, but basically what it is, they put you in a dark room and they put music on that's really, really loud so you can't hear anything. So you got a box over your head in a dark room, loud music, you have no idea what's going on. And they set up this like stage, if you will, for a scenario. Then they lift the box and you have like 10 seconds. They turn the music off, lift the box. You have 10 seconds for the instructor to tell you, this is your scenario, handle it. And you just go handle it.
Wow. Right?
Whatever that scenario is. Okay. And then when you're done with that scenario, they put the box back on, loud music. And you do this like 3 or 4 times. It's to get your heart rate up. It's to get you thinking. It's to get all the things going on while you're trying to handle these things. Right.
So that's intense, man.
One of mine was, it was like my second or third issue in my event. Right. So the first one was like some lady was asking for directions and, you know, you almost shoot her cause you're just all amped up but literally it's just somebody asking for directions. And then they put the box back down. So I had the box lifted one more time and the guy goes, okay. The instructor says, listen, it's a bank robbery. You are the first officer on scene. Go. I'm like, okay, perfect. So I look down at the scenario and I see down at the end of the room is like a fake bank. I'm like, okay, well, there's the bank. And then I look over here and there's cover. It's like a fence, you know, made up fence. So I'm like, all right, well, first thing you do, grab cover, right? Cover and concealment. So I get behind cover. And now I'm looking down at the bank and I see somebody coming out with a big fake bag of money, right? So I start giving the guy commands, like put the bag down, blah, blah, blah. I'm trying to get on the radio and call for backup. And there's somebody that's here with me already. So I was like, oh, perfect. So I turn to the right, to my right-hand side, and I look, and I'm like, hey, you know, can you help me on the radio here, call for backup because we need more stuff. And the guy just like took his gun out and shot me right there. Like he just started blowing fake rounds at me.
Oh,
and
I'm like, wow.
Buddy, what are you shooting at? And the instructor's like, I told you, you were the first officer on scene. This guy's not a cop. You're just talking to some jerk in the scenario, right? Turns out the jerk is another bank robber. And I'm like, oh my God, you know? So, anyways, but the funnier one was, so it's the last iteration. It's the last recruit going through. Okay. And we're all watching, the rest of us recruits are watching from behind as this one kid is going through in his last one. And they do a couple of box iterations and now it's the last one. And they lift the box and they say, male and female, females having medical issues and, you know, you got to attend to the medical crisis, whatever it is. So he rolls up on the male and the female that are there and the female's laying on the ground and she's like, I'm going to give birth. I'm going to have a baby. It's coming early. Oh my God. I don't know how to stop it. Blah, blah, blah. And the kid's trying to figure out what to do in his mind, right? Like, okay, get the radio. I got to do the thing. I got to see, is the whatever, is it happening? Who am I calling? And the cop, unbeknownst to anybody else, the instructor had brought in like a doll. And so he had like stuck it under his shirt and he was pushing this doll out like as he was actually giving birth. And instead of getting the joke, the recruit was like, oh, no, I got it. So he's like seriously trying to help the instructor give birth to this like Cabbage Patch doll.
Oh,
and
man.
We're all like, bro.
Oh, that's great.
And and then eventually the instructors were like, buddy, that wasn't real. Like I wasn't really oh my God, it was fucking it. Yeah. So my that's answer hilarious. Is there's a whole bunch of those stories that happen in the academy. And so yes, it can be like the movie sometimes.
That's funny, dude. Well, I guess you really need because it is there's a lot of intense training and stuff, you need to have that the steam blow off kind of thing.
So you get a,
yeah. That's great.
That's awesome, man. So let's talk about your podcast.
Yeah. So I just started, it's called Headlines in History. And I'm focusing right now, like I had said, on the foreign affairs and the military conflict stuff in the histories of those events that I'm discussing. Right. So what I'm trying to do here is I think there's a space for people that are interested in what's happening in the foreign affairs landscape.
Mm-hmm.
That is more than just what you're going to get in the news,
mm-hmm.
but it's not too much where they want to pick up 5 books and read it like if they're a historian.
Right.
So there's the everyday person watches the nightly news and like, oh, that boy, what's going on in Israel? That's crazy. You know, oh my Lord. But they want a little more that they're just not going to get from the news just to get a better handle on it.
Yeah.
But again, they don't want to take a college course. Right. So where do you find that space? And that's what I'm doing with the podcast. Cool. So last week, my topic was the Iranian president had died in a helicopter crash.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about how that occurred and how it wasn't Israel and all these other things tied into the Israel Gaza conflict. But then I also discussed, you know, the history of the president himself, why he was even chosen, why the Ayatollah picked him, and then what we think as, you know, an analyst community is going to happen to Iran going forward, who they're going to replace him with. So spend about about 45 minutes to an hour really digging into that one topic to give somebody enough something to chew on so they know that they have enough information to understand the context.
Very cool.
Yeah, yeah.
That's awesome, man. Much needed.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah, because unfortunately, I think that too many people, and I think it's a product of the American education system, but the people think about history as in, you know, names and dates and things, you know, they don't think about it as the story of, you know, how we got from this point to this point, because what's happening now in the news is not something that has, you know, been going on for, you know, 6 weeks or a year. It's been going on for 70 years or even or longer, depending on, you know, what it is that, yeah, you know, we're talking about, the issues and the countries involved and all of that stuff. And, yeah, we, you know, you can't cover that every night in the news, be, you know, and saying, well, of course, you know, it's all directly involved from the 1928 blah 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 or whatever border crisis of something or other. And yeah, so I think that's really good, because I mean, we know this, we say it, it's one of our maxims, you know you learn from history. You know, if you don't learn from, you know, if you forget history, you lose, you know. Or
there are a lot of axioms out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of it. Yeah. Yeah. History is important, yep. and it needs to be understood, and it needs to be something that is, you know, taught well. And unfortunately, I think, again, and it's not necessarily even teachers that are, because I mean, I had some great history teachers in high school, and you know, but it's just that they're limited of what they can do and what they can cover and in depth, because you've got to cover so much in such a short time. So that's really cool. We both, Barry and I, are both big, we like history, and we like stories. And so, you know, that's definitely sounds like something that's right up our alley for sure.
Yeah. And in the space is, and I like just history for itself. Right. And so I love listening to podcasts where they're like, okay, let's talk about the Revolutionary War, or let's talk about the Civil War. You know, I could eat that stuff up. Right. But there's a lot of that stuff out there. There's a lot of that stuff out there. So, you know, how do you parse through all that and become the next guy who talks about the Civil War? Right. So my plan is to, and as I've started, is to use that foreign affairs experience that I've had from being downrange three times and spending almost 30 years as an intelligence analyst and talking about the so what of today, grabbing a headline from today and saying, okay, what's the history from this today thing? And because it's in the forefront of everybody's mind. So four episodes ago, I did the fentanyl crisis, right? Last week, I did the presidential, the helicopter crash. And I did an interview this week with one of the lieutenant colonels that I work with, and she just got back from EUCOM, so the European Command, and she spent 3 months indirectly supporting the Ukraine fight against Russia. So obviously that's on everybody's mind. So we have a conversation about that, bring in some of the history there. So it's a today thing with a history thing, and we're mixing that together. So
very cool.
This has been fascinating, man.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming on, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
How often are you putting your podcast out?
Yep. So I'm an imperfect, but I try to get one out a week, and I've been successful so far. So 13 episodes. I've been doing it for 13 weeks, and I think I can maintain that. So we'll stick with once a week. Got a little YouTube channel to try and draw some attention there. So I do right now. I put the podcast on YouTube. And then I do some, headlines in history, same thing. And I try to do at least one short a day where I grab some media topic that came out foreign affairs related, and I'll give a quick little snippet, analysis, if you will, on whether it matters or whether it doesn't. Right. I threw one up today about, presidential election in Mexico, the first female president elected, if that's going to change anything on the border. The answer is no, but, you know, and just so I can provide some, you know, again, quick snippets and then draw some attention back to the podcast. So
I just followed on Spotify, so I'll be, checking that out and keeping that, adding to your numbers.
Nice.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks.
So are there other social media platforms that people can catch you on?
Yeah, so I have an Instagram under Headlines in History, but I have a website. So if you just go to headlinesinhistory.com, you can find the podcast on that website. You can also email me there, johnmollick@headlinesinhistory.com. I've got an email list that you can sign up for. It's nascent, but we're getting there. And I've got a connection to the to my YouTube shorts on there as well. So kind of drawing everybody back to that one website. So headlinesinhistory.com.
Awesome.
Yeah.
This has been.
Oh, absolutely incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, dude. Yeah, for real. You incredible stories, and I know
we haven't even scratched the surface.
Barely, yeah, I'm sure we barely scratched any kind of surface off.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even get the chance to talk about my brownies without the, well, let's put it this way. I'll give you a teaser so we can come back on next time. I'll tell you how a defendant of mine ended up getting 12 years in prison for selling coke only because he made a phone call about brownies without peanuts. Okay. That's great. And if this guy didn't smoke a pound of weed and make a phone call about brownies and peanuts, he'd be a free man today. That's really true. So we could talk about that one next time.
That's amazing.
We can talk serious stuff about Afghanistan and stuff if you want next time.
Yeah,
too. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Oh, man. Yeah, this has been amazing, man. And thank you again for coming on. We appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks, Adam. Thanks, Barry. Appreciate it.
Hey, you know what we need?
What's that?
We need a new ad for our merch store.
Our merch store.
I've had a few people reach out to me and ask me, just how do we get What's Your Weird Story merch?
Huh. How do we get that What's Your Weird Story merch?
What's-your, spelled Y-E-R, dash, weird, dash, story, dot, myspreadshop.com.
That's what's-your, spelled Y-E-R, dash, weird, dash, story, dot, myspreadshop.com.
That's correct. Get in touch with us. Go buy some merch. We got some cool stuff.
Yeah, dude. And you know what? If any of our listeners out there has some really cool ideas or has some really cool What's Your Weird Story type art that they want to see on a t-shirt, get a hold of us. Maybe it'll happen. John, thank you so much for all of that. That was incredible. We haven't had anybody, and we haven't had a wiretapper before. We probably had friends who've been tapped.
But yeah, yeah.
Actually, the person doing the tapping, you know, we haven't had that before.
Yeah, it's man, what a cool talk. And just I have a conspiracy mind. Sometimes I like to go down those rabbit holes, and so it was cool to be able to talk about some of those things and those apprehensions that the public may have when it comes to these types of things. But like, man, he just the story about, you know, the fentanyl crisis and what was going on there, and tapping into some of these gangs that are moving, you know, guns and all that kind of stuff is just, it's always fascinated me. I think it goes back to when I was a kid. I used to watch the cop shows, you know, and it just, I love it. And he was great, man. I just enjoyed that conversation.
Yeah. To learn about how the process goes.
Yeah.
It was very, very fascinating because, you know, they have to do everything by the books, you know, and they have to do it, keep it legal. And that's, you know, that's just a good protection for us, for citizens, you know.
Yep.
And criminals have, you know, their rights as well.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, they break the laws, but those, and when they break the laws, obviously, you know, those change, but you still have a right to privacy.
Yeah.
When you, you know, when you're talking to your mom or your friend, you know, your non-drug dealing friends, or, you know, having a sexy chat with your wife or other partner or whatever, you know, you can't just, the police and the feds can't just sit there and, you know,
yeah,
record that and you know, really get off on it.
Yeah.
Pun intended.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Yeah. So that was really cool.
And awesome. Just
the case. How he started off in the military as an analyst, and how he's just basically be able, once he got into civilian life, was be able to continue to do that and to do the wiretapping stuff,
yeah,
and analyzing all of that. Just it's, really, really cool. We're gonna definitely try to have John back,
yeah,
for sure, because you know that he's got some really cool stories, yeah, more cool stories.
Absolutely, and you know he you know, just it's just, you know, kind of what we were talking about in the beginning with the Veterans Day. Like, we're so thankful for people out there doing these things, and you mm-hmm. know, this is important work that you know, when we're facing these drug crises, that there's people out there that are trying to do some good and try to put a dent in the armor of the folks that are bringing it over. And it's a good thing, because you know, it's different now. You know, everything's laced with the stuff. I was listening to a guy talk the other day, and he works in like the sobriety field. You know, he's mm-hmm. He's one of these guys that counsels people, and he said that everyone that comes in that is drug tested, 100% of them test positive for fentanyl now. Because even if you're, you know, doing meth, it has fentanyl in it. If you're doing coke, it's got fentanyl. Everything is laced with the stuff, and that's scary, man. That's a scary thing. It that's no joke, and that's unfortunate.
It is an epidemic, and it's terrible. But you know, and that's always going to be part of, you know, we've got to change our ways on the war on crime. On the war on drugs, because we learned that the way we were doing it back in the 80s and 90s was not quite working out. Of course, we also had, you know, getting into not necessarily conspiracy theory, but, you know, we did have our own shadow elements of our own government that were pumping, bringing over heroin for, you know, and putting crack on the streets and stuff like that. So, you know, but it's heavy stuff, and in, you know, it needs, that's the kind of stuff that definitely needs to be controlled, because especially being so powerful that it can cause an overdose, but
yeah,
by getting on your skin. I always thought that was a little bit of a fiction,
yeah,
about how fentanyl could, you know, you could just get it on your skin and
yeah,
stuff. But apparently, it's true.
Yeah, there's Did you ever hear the? You ever hear the zombie drug that's down in like Colombia, where they blow powder in your face and you go out, but you're still awake. You ever heard of this?
I don't know. It sounds like, I mean, I know
it's that the great Kabuki
had a green mist.
Yeah, no, this is the real deal, man. And they'll take people and they'll target them, and they blow this powder in their face, and then they'll take them and they'll clean out their bank accounts, because the person is totally awake, but they are unable to like make decisions. And it's wild, but that kind of stuff is scary, and fentanyl kind of fits into that, where it's like,
yeah,
all you gotta do is get in contact with it and you could be in major yeah, trouble, you know. So
say no to drugs, kids.
Please
You know, and the irony of this episode is that during our conversation with John, I had some trouble on my line, and I dropped out halfway through the interview. And then when I came back on, the recording program, which is on Barry's computer,
yep,
stopped recording Barry's voice. So I was going through doing the edit for this several months ago, and there was just all of a sudden these long gaps where John would be talking, and then there'd be a gap, and then he would start up again.
Yeah.
And then there'd be a gap, and then I would say something, and then there'd be a gap, and then John would talk again. And so it.
I went very, missing. It, I went it missing.
Very, went missing. He went missing. It was a very strange event because it makes no sense to me technologically how I dropped out of the call, but then it cut your mic
very
whenever
strange.
I came back in. And it hasn't happened before.
Yeah.
But, you know, I challenge you out there to find where the phone call was dropped and where Barry had to go back in and redo all of his questions and responses during a portion of the interview. So I challenge you to find the areas that, you know, Barry redid, because I listened to it myself, having been there in person and had listened to it, the unedited, you know, audio loss version, and then the edited version, and I forgot in it where things happened. So yeah.
Well, hey, the winner of that gets a teddy bear.
Yes, yes, and or a teddy, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah, that was weird, and I'm so thankful that we at least salvaged what we had, and he didn't get cut off, because that would have been a no go.
That would have been much worse. That'd been tragic.
Yeah, it was so strange though. Yeah, like you said, it never happened before, and that thought never even crossed my mind that something like that could happen. And then then we figure out that it did happen. So, but
but you nailed it, dude. You were hesitant. You were intimidated by the task. But you did a great job.
I appreciate it. Well, we really wanted to get thank you, man. We really wanted to get this out because it was such a good episode. So. Yep. So happy that we were able to do that. Thank you, John, for coming, man. You you killed it, dude.
Go and check out John's podcast, Headlines in History. It's really cool if you're history buffs like us, and you can, you know, it gives you the broader depth of what is going on in the world by understanding what's come before, how we got to these places. And I know a lot of people are asking themselves, how do we get here? You know, and there's the answers are often very different than what you think it might be.
Yeah.
And it'll include moving pieces and factors that you were completely unaware of.
Yeah.
That's one of the beautiful things about history, is that there's this entire planet and there are things that go on one side of the planet, the small thing that has ripple effects or puts into motion, you know, all sorts of things that end up being major events somewhere else.
Yep. Cool stuff.
Yeah. Go check out John's podcast, Headlines in History. And if you got the time, we got the ears. We want to hear your history. We want to hear all about your stories. You know, if you've got a cool job, an interesting job, a unique job, like John. We would love to hear about that. You know, if you've got cool family history stories, mysteries, stuff like that, we love hearing those. Of course, we always want to hear about your encounters in the supernatural and the paranormal with Bigfoot and UFOs and ghosts and such. We like hearing about the funny stories and the misadventures and all of that stuff, your tragedies. And try to bring a bright side out of those. So get a hold of us. Get a hold of us on our social media, Instagram, Facebook, and, you know, we will set something up. We would love to talk to you. And if you, again, as always, if you don't want to be on the mic, if you don't want to rock the mic, you don't got to rock the mic, you can write your story out and email that in. And, you know, it could be a long story. It could be short, just like your regular stories and your interviews here on the podcast. Doesn't have to be hour long. Doesn't have to be, you know, 30 minutes, any shape or size. You know, they always generate discussions. And, you know, that's what we like.
Absolutely.
So don't you fret. Don't you fret about the size of your story. You know, we'll work with it and we'll make it interesting. I'm sorry, I got distracted by my own thoughts there, and I realized I was getting how do you get out? Another yeah. sticky situation. Anyway, join us here in Weirdsville. See how that stuff happens live in person if you join us on an interview, or yeah, write out your stories and send them to us. You can do it through the social media or our email, which is wywspod@gmail.com. And we will see you next time. Barry, thank you so much. You did a great job. I appreciate what you've done, man.
Thank you. You too, man.
If you see a veteran, thank a veteran. We thank you all. And we respect you all. And I do want to wish Mr. Smiling Sensei Barry Johnson a very happy birthday tomorrow, the 13th. Oh,
thanks, man.
And he's getting older.
Another year of fermentation, man. Thanks. All right. Man.
Have a good one, Barry. Happy birthday. And Weirdsville, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Until then, be safe.
Be weird.
As always, if you have a weird story, we want to hear it.
If you have a lot of them, we want to hear them all.
We can't do this podcast without your invaluable contributions.
Whether it's sharing your stories,
listening,
rating,
and spreading the word about the podcast. Thanks for listening. Till next time, be safe.
Be weird.
The stories presented on the What's Your Weird Story podcast are, to our knowledge, true experiences that our guests have had. We can't take the time to research all claims made, and besides, it's just not as fun.